Yeah, no, they're fine. Both cameras and one, two, both cameras and one, are working just fine. And then just take a picture every once in a while.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Take a picture every once in a while.
Anything else?
Every 12 days.
Did anything else move besides that little slide of dirt there?
Yeah, they've had a number of changes in the pictures as spring came on and the dust storm moved a bit. Quite a number of places where there is dust where there was not before. There was
kind of
deposited by the frost. Yeah, they finally got one point where it was frost.
Yeah.
It was not frozen from the outside, it was frozen water vapor. And that seems very strange at first because at that season, the March of the year, you don't expect anything like that emitted in the air to, you know, produce any noticeable frost on the ground. What happened was it was a dust storm wind that was carrying a lot of these things off. And that didn't become evident until they had a chance to look at the water vapor data and work. Turns out there's much more humid up there than we expected. Furthermore, this Martian year is rather different from the last one. You know, we've now got observations for an entire Martian year. There's a closed seasonal cycle, but it didn't close. The temperature is somewhere 50 degrees colder this year than what it came down last year, and the winds are not the same either. So, very much variability, and we will talk about this more in the meteorology data. It's the one we know so far, yeah. Well, it's certainly surprising that those two moons, which are so small, so many of the variables that give you variety of planets are absent. Obviously, there's no variety due to atmospheres, for example, because there's no atmosphere. You know, there's no variety of internal activity because they're too small or whoever had it, and so on. And they're at the same place in the solar system.
Okay. Well,
they didn't even think it was that way. You go back to the 1930s version of Mars, and it was basically a separate Earth and so was Venus. You know, relative monster difference. Sure. Yeah. Right. But I think it's amazing to see that there is as much difference as there is. If it was just a matter of position, there would not be as much variation as you get. For example, if it was just a matter of position, you'd expect Mercury to be the hottest planet. It's not. Venus is. So position is by no means everything. It's not even a major variable. I'm just saying that so much. Yeah. Okay, obviously what it comes down to is basically an aesthetic judgment in the end. You're apparently less surprised at it than I am, that's all.
No, that's not
a matter of knowledge. It's a matter of how you react to the knowledge. My reaction was to be very surprised at how much variety there is. You apparently would take that for granted. So I'm not any more surprised than you. So, but there is certainly an awful lot of variety.
You said Venus is hotter than Mercury. Even the Calaris Basin area?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
What's the temperature of the Calaris Basin?
The Calaris Basin area gets about 450 degrees Fahrenheit. That's hotter than Mercury. And Venus is 900.
Yeah.
So, the reason Venus is hotter is that it has a very expensive atmosphere with trapped heat from the Sulfur Moon atmosphere. And you see, that's really overwhelming the position, the effective position of the
solar system.
No, I don't think I ever said that. The one thing that's the difference between buildings and the rest of the planet.
Well, no, the idea that it is in time, so probably something that you remember, was that if you replace Jupiter here, you
didn't
know how to.
I seem to remember having a discussion with you about that time, and you expressed this idea, and I said, no, that's what people thought.
Well, the idea is that you're.
So now you're taking up that off and putting words in my mouth.
Well, the idea is that it's very open to hypothesis, and it's that there
I just don't think that's what people think. There, I won't deny that this is important, and clearly this issue in some ways is why building plants didn't form closer to some humans. It may be that in fact dying has been 4 inches in that quote in. But on the other hand, that's all there were to it, and I find it interesting that they didn't all of building plants, even when closer to the time. It was just the transposition with a dominant variable we expect to get bigger and bigger and have a higher and higher density of hydrogen as you go out in the sun. In fact, if anything, it's the other way around. Here is the next one may not have anything like the next part of Jupiter and Saturn. We don't know this. We didn't know that one. But there are a lot of people that don't.
So it's a variable to push it out.
Oh, yeah, sure.
But what you do, you could end up in the
Well, then you could. That's the point. I don't think by any means where you could. That you could not have a dual plant closer. The Russians may very well know. problem and all of it in front of the people alone.
And
we
one virus
up to
the
Yeah. I always feel crazy when somebody asks me for the best or my favorite or something like that anyway. So. I heard about half of that. I heard you think about zero and you think much of that. I guarantee I never said anything about zero and you're right. Well, you have no idea what the sizes are, but if you look at the brightness ratios, the moon is something like a third, a quarter of the diameter of the wood. The moon landing is on campus, CHAR. If one of you goes to Uranus, what? Pictures of the ring? It's expanding, yes. That's one of the big reasons we're sending it on Uranus. Very little attention has been done about the details of the Uranus flyby. You know, they're worried so far about getting to Jupiter. And that's a real problem with the partial failure, with the complete failure of one of these, even the partial failure of another. It's really taking an awful lot of nerve. The last time I talked to somebody and asked about that, that's been a public information office. But he was talking to Louis Newman about the prospect that they were going to put up a valve over the earth. However, I see them do that happen too. Well, look, I can't give you, you know, a lecture on the entire solar system. We're getting all kinds of information from Pioneer 10, and you know, that's another whole lecture to do.
Yeah.
What is the
type of thing
going
on about,
which,
not that they've already
actually
been doing funding and launching, in the next 10 years,
where will there be 10 tons launching? Well, again, that's a whole lecture. The next one, the next planetary mission after next year, will be Galileo, formerly Jupiter Orbiter Probe, which was named Y, the spacecraft and system in an orbiter, which would keep visiting the outer tube before they come. And the probe which would go into Jupiter itself. It looks pretty good at present. That would be launched in 1982. We'll be there for 3 years. It'll take 15 years. In fact, it'll go by Mars, believe it or not, for gravity. if you think Mars for gravity just to go to Jupiter is sort of incredible. The shuttle has been sent to the International Space Station. ability to manipulate your arm, distorting of your elimination to build the facial and so forth. But that hasn't crossed the iron curtain. Cross iron curtain cooperation has so far been one of the biggest challenges. We do exchange data. There's been a data exchange before there anything. So we tell them what we do have to do, what we do have to do, what we do have to do, well, on Pioneer, the resolution is about half that of you and I can sing this to you in Pioneer Jupiter. And Mariner, because we can't walk together, the resolution of Mariner 4 was pretty miserable, the resolution of Mariner 10 was pretty incredible. Vikings? Well, you've seen them. I mean, I showed you a bunch of Viking orbiter pictures of the Troy Lecture. You know, and I also mentioned that the resolution of the camera is about 10 times better than you and I would have to make it. And what do we see? Voyager. Voyager pictures of Jupiter from 2 months out are better than the Venus Ripley telescopic pictures. And from 3 weeks out, they're better than the Velocity 10 and 11 pictures. At closest approach, you know, maybe you see pictures, the picture of the Great Red Spot taking close up on Pioneer 11. That was an impressive picture. I mean, here's a picture of the Great Red Spot covering this much up. At closest approach, people came dozens of Voyager frames just to fill the red spot. You're going to get 200,000 pictures from each spacecraft, from each flyby. Picture at a rate of about every 10 quarters for 2 months. You know, and the news media will show you 3 of them.
That's
certainly one of the Martian albedo pictures disappeared when we got there, so maybe it will.
Well, that's
the
one
of the
right.
This is
probably
a
very dumb question.
That's true. Next question. Sorry.
Maybe
I was worried that when people say, this is a dumb question, because I know the answer, I was so off. I wish you wouldn't do that.
I guess you can't see the answer already, but it's fine. Is Dawkins schedule on shuttle for...
It is not flown on entry flight. When they send it to a docking, they can stick it in the cargo.
The cargo?
Yep.
No, wait a minute. They just pulled out the docking after the cargo bay, and left the spaceship there, and got onto it.
Exactly.
Yeah, but I'll climb out.
You're going to see a lot of weird sights all over the shuttle here, starting with the takeoff of that thing, you know, where it takes off early with all the engines firing like a bunch of bananas stepping off.
Wait a minute. Once they dock, they got both of them.
Yeah.
How do they climb out?
They don't. Yeah, no, they can. The EVA hatch is not the same as the docking hatch. Separate EVA hatch.
But they
call them the No, they don't have to do that. They normally will go through the docking hatch. When you
want to
go outside, you can be covered with the docking hatch.
Well,
the door is open. Okay, the cargo bay is like the roller coaster, but suppose the cabin is up there, and they want that pointing up toward you. The docking module over here is a thing that goes back here, and then a thing that goes up here a little bit, and then goes back here.
So there's a tunnel to the cabin.
Yeah. It's the same tunnel as you need to get the space flight when you're flying that. This is from 300 miles away. This is Viking Orbiter 1. That person was Viking Orbiter 2. Here comes the Viking Orbiter. Thank you.
quite surprised then. Gentleman asked me a question during the intermission, which was a very good one, and which I want to share with everybody. And that is, when you look at a picture like this one, and here is a magnificent Viking Orbiter 2 photograph, TV image actually, of Phobos from a distance of only 600 miles. And you can see things on this as small as 120 feet across. And if you didn't have something, wait till you see the end of the sequence. I'm going to show you four slides, each of them twice as close as the previous. And that means the closest one is going to get it down to only 30 miles away from Phobos. Well, it's going to give a 30-foot resolution, and it's going to get it down to 150 miles from that. When we get there, I'll figure it out. This one is 600, right? So 600, 300, 150, 75 miles from Phobos. And the reason I'm getting confused is I will then show you the closest picture ever taken of a celestial object. A photograph that was made by Viking Orbiter 2 of Deimos from a distance of 30 miles. And that is so close that it would have been easier to hit the thing than to come that close and hit. And the target, so you can see another gravity. When you get that close, the gravity of the moon is actually beginning to dominate the motion of the spacecraft. So this is a really, really incredible thing. But what I wanted to point out is that the gentleman asked me, you know, you look at a picture like this, and it does not look black. And I've been telling you about how dark these things are, and how you reflect only 2% of the light that hits them. This is actually quite an overexposed picture in the usual sense. In other words, if there were a patch down there of the same brightness as a human face, and pick any race you want, they're considerably higher albedo than Phobos is. If there was a patch down there of the same brightness as a human face, it would be glaring white. It'd be totally overexposed as far as you can tell. So these are really quite long exposures. And if you expose long enough on anything, providing you're producing some light, you know, it's not just a sheer black sky and nothing else, then sooner or later you can get a pure white if you want.
When they were taking these pictures, now I know they had the scan platform for when they were doing the close shots.
Right.
Were they rolling the craft or just using the scan platform?
They were just using the scan platform. And this one is a scan platform moving picture.
Does it have variable speed?
It has two speeds. And so what you do is you calculate as to when the spacecraft, as it approaches the moon, is going to be moving at the right angular speed so that one of those two speeds is appropriate. What we're talking about is this. These spacecraft were never designed to be able to take this kind of picture. The exposure that you need is long enough that when you come this close, the motion of the spacecraft relative to the moon would peter out the picture so that it was essentially useless. As you will see, in a very close picture of Phobos, there is some peering. The resolution is degraded, so it's only 40 feet, instead of the 15 or so that you would have for one of that. But that's just in one direction. And furthermore, since it is the same image elements that are being smeared out, with enough computer processing, you can undo a great deal of that smearing. The picture that I'm going to show is a fairly early version. I do not know if it's had a chance to do that computer processing yet. The budget for that sort of thing has just got cut. And they're really behind on that sort of thing, and they have to give Mars priority. But they will do it eventually if they haven't done it already. What he's talking about, though, is that the spacecraft was not designed to be able to take such pictures, but the cameras and several of the other instruments that observe Mars and Phobos and so on are mounted on a movable platform called the scan platform. And the purpose of this is so that you can point the cameras wherever you want, even if that particular side of the spacecraft is not the side of ordinarily you're pointing toward Mars. The spacecraft does have to have a particular orientation. Solar panels have got to be pointing at the sun, the side of the antenna has got to be pointing here, and so on and so forth. So the engineers, during the Viking mission, got the idea of actually moving the scan platform during the exposure so as to compensate for the motion of the image past the spacecraft. It had never been designed to do anything like that. But they tried it, and after a number of experiments which didn't work, where they got smears that were worse than they would have otherwise, they learned how to do it. And this, in fact, was the first picture they ever took using that technique that worked. They did it first with the moon, and then, as a result of having learned how to do it with the moon, they moved into the spacecraft so that their closest approaches to Mars were, at the end, only one-fifth of what the mission had been designed for, and began taking really super high-resolution photographs of the Martian surface as well, one of which was so fine that it began to show small craters in the area of Viking Lander 1, and they finally were able to figure out exactly where Viking Lander 1 was on the surface relative to the pictures, so we now know that directly. Orbiter 2, they were trying, or Lander 2 rather, they were trying that on the last I heard. I believe that they got it, but I don't want to swear to that. So this is just an example of something I pointed out in the earlier lectures about Apollo, the way even during the mission evolved so that they ended up being able to do so much more than they really expected. Is he a hand over there?
Yeah. Yeah, I'm wondering about the sensitivity. How much of that could you have seen with your naked eye if you had been in the thing?
How much would you see with your naked eye? What you're thinking of is because they're so black. But the thing is that if you are presented with a visual field consisting of a lot of rock, no matter how bright or dark it may be, and black sky, your eye will simply adapt until it's able to see the detail. So the answer is, the cameras are much more, have much finer resolution than the human eye, about 10 times finer. So you have to get 10 times closer than the spacecraft was. But if you did that, you would see essentially the same thing, aside from perspective difference by being closer with the naked eye. What you would not see would be if you were trying to look at this kind of detail as it was silhouetted against the surface of Mars. But of course, even the spacecraft, there's no reason to flood the optics with all that light and thereby get a blur of reflected light all over the picture, and so they photographed it so that it was against a dark sky. Please understand that this is highly computer processed, and there are some things here that are artifacts of the processing. For example, this herringbone pattern in the sky was not real, I guarantee. What you're seeing there is the terminator, the edge of the illuminated portion of Phobos. In other words, this is day and this is night. And you are seeing the dark side of Phobos here, and then a little bit of sky probably down at the corners. Now, what these pictures show is, of course, first of all, one heck of a lot of craters. If you look at them, you will find they look rather like lunar craters, but there are exceptions. The main exception is you do not see ejecta blankets around even the most well-defined craters. Ejecta blankets means piles of material that were thrown out by the impact and then landed. These bodies are so small that ejecta are simply blasted out into space, or at the very least, they come down as a thin powdering over the entire surface of the moon. The gravity on Phobos and Deimos varies from place to place because of their non-spherical shape, but a typical average is that the gravity is about strong enough that you could not jump off Phobos with your own unaided muscles, but a good kangaroo could. And any baseball pitcher could put an object into orbit around Phobos with his own unaided muscle power. So there is not very much gravity, and if a meteorite comes along and hits them several miles a second, it's simply going to blast most of the material out into space. Nevertheless, Phobos' surface, and it is not obvious from the pictures, this is from infrared observations and that sort of thing, does consist of a regolith, a quote, soil layer, end quote, soil rock layer, produced by micrometeorite bombardment in the same way as the surface of the moon does. We expect still smaller objects probably don't even have regoliths, but Phobos and Deimos as well apparently are such a size that they don't have ejecta blankets around their craters, or almost none of them do. There's occasional mini ejecta blanket that you can see trying to show itself in around an occasional crater, not doing a very good job at it, but they do have a regolith. You can see the effects of micrometeorite erosion on the crater. You can see that some of them are considerably less sharp than others. For example, there is a relatively young crater. I don't know what that means in terms of ages, of course. We have no rocks back in these bodies. Typical guess would be, that means only 2 billion years old or something like that. But there you have a nice, sharp, well-defined crater. Compare that with this more rounded crater there. Compare it with this still more eroded crater there. Compare that with that almost destroyed crater that is down here. And you can see that there is a considerable spectrum of crater ages, crater on top of crater. Like the moon, Phobos is saturated with craters. There is no place that you could land on Phobos and not be inside a crater of some size. The really shocking thing from this discovery, from this picture, though, was not the craters, which we already knew existed from American 9 pictures. It was these grooves. And you can see that the grooves are covering most of the picture. They are in two different directions, and those directions are 30 degrees to one another. Now, 30 degrees happens to be a magic number when you are talking to a geologist about sets of linear features. Because if you take a rock and you stress it, either by pulling it apart or by pushing it together until it finally fails, in other words, cracks, you might think intuitively that it would fail either in the direction perpendicular to the force or parallel to the force. In fact, you can show mathematically it does neither. It fails at a 30-degree direction or a 60-degree direction, depending on whether you're pulling it apart or pushing it together. And I never can remember which is which, but the point is that the that 30 degree number. And so it looks as though we have here the signature of some sort of stress that is now or was once applied to the surface of Phobos. The question, though, is why do you have those grooves that way? At least a lot of the grooves appear as though they are little chains of craters. On the moon, you frequently see grooves like this, and you frequently see chains of craters. The grooves are the linear rills, which some of you may remember from two lectures back on Monday, and they are graben, that is to say, the place where the ground has been shocked. What does the shock mean? It's a very large meteorite impact that forms one of those basins, the super large craters on the moon. That forms faults, in other words, the ground cracks and moves, and they are parallel, and the ground falls down in between them. That is a characteristic response of rock that has been exposed to a shock in such a way that it's pulled apart somewhat. The two faults, if you imagine a cross section here, are formed like a V, the truncated V like so, and the ground then falls down between them into that V-shaped region. And I think you can see how that is a way that the ground can take up a stress that is pulling it apart. Okay? All this is possible simply because the ground does, the rock does fail at a 30-degree angle or 60-degree angle and not perpendicular. Obviously, it fails perpendicularly when you do it good to have those faults forming. But the very fact that it does form that way allows it to take up stress in such a manner. Nevada is a classic example of a place where the whole state is simply covered with one set of these V's after another where the ground has fallen down. And the reason for that is that the entire crust in the Nevada portion of the Earth has been pulled apart by something. We're still arguing over what. Geologists are still arguing over what. But Nevada is at least 150 miles wider now than it was before all that started. And you go out there, drive across Nevada from east to west, and it's just one after another valley, which is a graben, and mountain range, low mountain range, which is the portion between two neighboring gravens. And the result, and that is the result of forming a part of the crust. Okay, on the moon you have these graben, and they are produced as a result of the ground being shocked by the basin forming impact. Therefore, not too surprisingly, the graben radiate out in all directions away from the central basin crater. What was startling about these features is that they are parallel to one another. That is, you've got two sets of them, one go this way, and those are all parallel. And you have another set, which is not well represented in this particular picture, and those go at a 30-degree angle to the first set. One of the sets runs along the greatest, the equatorial direction of Phobos, defining the equator as a cross-section which is the biggest ellipse, and that is the direction that is in the plane of Phobos' orbit around Mars, and the other is 30 degrees in that direction. So it suggests that what's happening is Phobos is so close to Mars, which is known to be, that the tidal forces that Mars exerts on Phobos are so great that the moon has begun to be pulled apart. That was an interesting suggestion, and it's probably not true. Let's go to another picture, and I'll show you why. Here is a picture taken from 300 miles away, and you can see that the cracks are not everywhere. They are very well defined at that 30-degree angle. Here are two of them, which are parallel, no, very linear that is, which are parallel to the Phobos equator, parallel to the direction of Phobos' orbit around Mars. And here's one at a 30-degree angle, and there's another 30-degree angle, and there's another. And you can see they're not everywhere. And when you map Phobos using these super high-resolution pictures, it turns out that the grooves are most numerous around the crater's thickness. They don't radiate out from the thickness, but they are most numerous around Sydney. And then if you go around to the opposite spot, remember Sydney is the biggest crater of Phobos, and then if you go around to the opposite side of Phobos, exactly opposite to Sydney, they die out entirely. So apparently, they were at least triggered by the formation of Sydney, by the impact of the new Sydney. Now, notice that in this picture, even more clearly than the last one, here you have twice the resolution, so you can see twice the detail. And in this picture, they appear to be lines of craters. And even one that appears, if you imagine at a little bit poorer resolution, this one might appear as, let's get it about there, this one might appear as a straight line as a groove. When you get the better resolution, you can see that it does in fact turn into a line of craters. Now we see features like that on the moon too, little lines of craters.
obviously those were not formed by meteorite impact, because that'd be too much of a bunch of random meteorites to happen to form perfectly straight line. Meteorites are not generally present with that much intelligence. Therefore, it is commonly assumed that these are the result of some sort of volcanic process, probably not anything really spectacular, major eruptions of lava or whatever, just places where gas is being erupted from inside the moon. The difficulty with that is that I've already given you abundant evidence that Phobos and Deimos have never melted, that they have never managed to generate enough internal heat to produce volcanic processes in the first place, and so you ask yourself what's going on.
Well, let's go to another picture and get still more information, and perhaps we can figure it out. This is from 300 miles away. This is Viking Orbiter 1. That first one was Viking Orbiter 2. Here comes a Viking Orbiter 1 picture from 150 miles away. Magnificent picture, right at the terminator. And you can see that all of them, whether they appear to be grooved at lower resolution or not, do in fact resolve themselves into chains of craters. What we also see that at this resolution, the whole surface is peppered with small, young craters. See how fresh all those are? So there's been a lot of fairly recent meteorite bombardment of Phobos. At the moment, the general party line picture for, which is not agreed by everybody, for the origin of these grooves, which, by the way, Phobos has and Deimos does not, as you will see when I show you a close-up picture of Deimos. So Phobos is the groovy one, and Deimos is not. The general picture for their origin is this. When Phobos formed, there were stresses in the rock as a result of whatever process led to its formation. The rock formed stress. Those stress patterns were at 30-degree angles to one another. It is doubtless not coincidence that when whatever body came along and hit Phobos and fall off matter to leave behind the ellipsoid, that the long axis of the ellipsoid is parallel to one of the directions of stress. Okay? So you're going to have a more or less built-in circumstance that it will be the one of those directions of the groove is going to be parallel to the orbital motion of Phobos around Mars. Because as soon as you form the ellipsoid, the long axis of the ellipsoid is going to be attracted to the point towards Mars by Mars' tidal. Okay? We have the stresses. Then, after the falling event, along comes the meteoroid, which formed 50, the impact of which was so great that it very nearly knocked Phobos apart. It did open up cracks, and naturally those cracks opened along the directions of the stresses. And there were volcanic eruptions of a very strange kind along those grooves, along those cracks where they opened up. Remember, please, that carbonaceous chondritic material contains water. The heat of the impact was not great enough to vaporize the rock that Phobos came out of, except at the place where the crater itself is. But it was great enough that it heated the entire body of the moon, with the possible exception of the spot directly opposite the 50, enough to vaporize water. And so you had steam eruptions coming up through the cracks. Those produced these lines of analyte pits that you see there along the groove. And afterwards, of course, everything quieted down. All of this happened definitely billions of years ago. Note the number of the small young craters, and note how there are just as many of them in the grooves as in the spaces in between. That means that the grooves formed quite a long time ago, as Phobos history goes. And our estimates of how often a given meteorite of a given size will hit Phobos are crude, because we don't know what the proximity of the asteroid belt will do. If this were the moon, we could give you estimates quite well. You know, show me that many craters per cubic mile on the moon, I'll tell you the number, the age and billions of years of that particular part of the lunar surface. But for Mars, we don't know that too well yet, because we're close to the asteroid belt. But it's clearly several billion years. That, in turn, is the reason why we do not think the grooves have anything to do with Mars exerting tidal force on Phobos and trying to pull it apart now. Because if that were the case, then at least some of the grooves would appear recent and would not show a large number of small impact craters in them. Okay? So at the moment, this is what we think those grooves are, and stay tuned for later developments. Now, finally, I want to show you, and actually I don't have much intelligence to say about it, what I have intelligence to say I've already said, but I want to show you, just so you can see it, the closest picture that's ever been taken of Phobos. That, mind you, is not the moon, that horizon appearing in that little curve. That is actually Phobos.
The bright sky is an artifact of computer processing. We have not discovered an atmosphere above both in the picture. But you can see the picture is somewhat blurred. The resolution is degraded so that it's only 40 feet as a result of residual spacecraft motions they weren't able to compensate for perfectly with the motion of the scan platform, but still it is a truly remarkable picture. And the biggest crater in this entire picture is only a quarter of a mile across. Yeah. That's the kind of scale that you're talking about. Now, you think that's something. Yeah, that's the size of the Michigan State campus. That's a good analogy. Thank you. You think that's something. Now look at this picture, which is Deimos from only 30 miles away. From the top to the bottom of that picture is only about a mile. You are seeing features in this picture 15 feet across. In other words, you can almost see a human being in this picture. Your first reaction is probably, gee, that's a lousy picture. Because you know what's so blurred? It's not blurred, for example, by spacecraft motion or by the camera being out of focus. Observe how there are rocks. We didn't see very many of those on the surface of Phobos. So here's the difference between Phobos and Deimos. There are rocks, and they are in quite sharp focus. There is a young crater. It's obviously sharp. The reason the picture appears blurred is that the surface of Deimos is blurred. Deimos is apparently covered by a layer of dust, by a regolith, deep enough to have buried all but the youngest craters. In other words, well, historically, if I use the word historically, because I'm going to go back 2 years, when we got the first pictures of Deimos, we thought that it was not saturated with craters the way Phobos is. That there were large areas on Deimos' surface where there were no craters at all. And that seems very hard to understand, considering that Phobos had no such area. Now, when we get these very close-up pictures, it becomes obvious that indeed, Deimos' surface is totally saturated by craters. There are craters everywhere. There are very badly eroded ones, like this big one. Remember, big only is a relative term, and it's still only a mile from top to bottom. And there are sharp craters like this one, and there are an awful lot of craters just dimly visible through the dust layer. So Deimos is indeed saturated in craters, but Deimos has had a different history from Phobos. And we have the foggiest notion why. But it has. What's happened is Deimos underwent an intense cratering effort, just as Phobos did, just as the moon did, just as every planet in the solar system did. Then somehow Deimos had formed on it this smothering dust layer, which covered most of those craters. Phobos did not have the same thing, or if it had it, it doesn't have blown away. More or less, most likely, therefore, it never happened. And then since then, a relatively small number of craters, some of which produce big boulders and ejecta, have formed on top of the dust layer. So you see, it's very different, and you do not see the rules on it. And it's a different type of carbonaceous contrast. I never cease to be astonished. I've mentioned this many times before, and those of you who know my life have noticed one of my standard themes. I never cease to be astonished as we go out and find out what the universe is really like with our spacecraft, by what the solar system is really like, as compared to what we thought it was like back when all we had was telescopic observations from Earth. How every single world, not only planets but moons as well, insists on being a unique individual unlike all the others. The Earth is very different from Venus, even though they are close in time. Mars is very different from both. Jupiter and Saturn, those are very different from each other. The moons of Jupiter, although they are comparable in size, in fact, those four big ones, turn out to be very, very different from one another in scale. Mercury looks superficially like the moon, but inside it has totally different structures, mostly an iron core. The moons have no iron core, very little. Now it turns out that even these two tiny little moons of Mars, objects that are so small that you would think there aren't enough variables left to make them different from one another. We always took for granted that when you see one asteroid, you've seen them all. Or at least when you see one asteroid, maybe more or less than a rock that you've seen them all. It turns out that even these bodies are completely different from one another when you get down to look at their surfaces in enough detail to see them. It's astonishing. It makes you wonder if there are really any two worlds in the universe that are alike. And of course, this is a very important point. For example, many astronomers have made the assumption that just because we're here, Earth-type planets, there can't be anything unusual about them. So Earth-type planets must be very common throughout the universe, and Earth-type life must be very common throughout the universe. It really makes you wonder how true an assumption like that is. I'm not saying that I don't sure it's not true. I'm not saying that I don't believe that there's that way elsewhere too. I'm saying it wouldn't surprise me if it turned out that it was not. I just don't think we know enough to be able to say. So when Stephen Fogel's name up meant to show individuality, what's it going to turn out when we get out there and look at the earliest examples? All these hundred books will tell you which one. How many differences do you think there's going to be different ones? I'll bet you, I would be willing to bet, not a whole lot, we can't afford to lose a whole lot, but I'm willing to bet, you know, up to what I can afford to lose, 25%, what the heck? That when we get out of the earliest answers, and we're as much about those who know about Mars and Venus today, we will think of those as being radically different worlds. If you were at the distance of Uranus and Neptune and looking at Uranus and Venus, I'm sure you would think they were identical. Are each cell the same size? And it looks totally coming from the class, as far as you can tell from that too. And same LB, as far as you can tell. So at that distance, the kind of resolution that we have only here in the next, you know, 1,000-mile resolution or forward, you would be able to tell if they're holding the class. You think they're totally different.
I was going to ask, inside that large eroded crater, is that another crater with an ejecta blanket?
Yeah, a little black thing in here. You know, that's just about the deepest part of the deepest hole in this picture. And it's possible that what you have there is some darker layer which has been brought up to the surface, has been excavated up to the surface. The soil must be very fine material, because it's so relatively high in albedo. Now remember, the albedos here are not reliable in the sense that this is much brighter than you'll see, you know, if you have the rock in front of you and have a chance to look at it in the light of this room. But clearly this stuff is darker than this stuff. And that very well, assuming that indeed we're right, these are undifferentiated bodies, that presumably implies that this is coarser material, and that could very well mean that it is a young ejecta plane. Yeah?
Can you rely on those albedos and see anything really suggested?
You can rely on relative albedos only up to a certain extent. A television camera is a lousy recommendation because its sensitivity varies from point to point across the faceplate of the Vagon tube and varies in a manner that is essentially impossible to calibrate. Even if you measure it before the spacecraft moves around, it will change as the Vagon moves. So, to a certain extent, yes. If you see something real flat, something real white, you're not going to get out there and establish very fast the same albedo. But if you see something that's 1% lighter than something else, don't rely on it at all. You know, there are different places on the picture. Okay, I want to finish up the lecture by just showing you a few fun-sized pictures. Really, owe you all the information at this point, you're almost all of it. Here's a picture of our own moon, which I took in Ann Arbor a number of years ago, showing a phenomenon that you're all familiar with. It has the old poetic English name, the old moon, the new moon's arm. Astronomers call it Earth shine. The phenomenon where you have a steep crescent moon, that is, of the sunlit hemisphere of the moon, most of it is turned away from the Earth, and so we're seeing only a small part of that. And yet, the dark part you can see. Note incidentally, in this picture, it looks as though the radius of the bright part is greater than the radius of the dark part. That is a photographic effect called irradiation. What's happened is I overexposed the bright crescent necessarily in order to be able to show the dark portion, and we overexpose them, we tend to make it look bigger. Human eye has a somewhat analogous effect. And if you look, in fact, at the moon that looks this way, you will see the same thing. It looks as though the bright crescent is bigger, and it really can shake you up. I remember one piece of crime literature many years ago that a friend of mine delightfully pointed out to me. Picture of Mars, and here's the south polar cap. And this was way back when we were still looking at the astronomical pictures of the south up, so it was the top of the picture. And the south polar cap is much brighter than anything else on the surface of Mars, so it was overexposed in the picture. And there's the south polar cap sitting up there, you know, about 200 miles above the surface of Mars, and the author fell for it, and the author really won, and constructed this whole theory out of the super mountains of the south pole of Mars. Well, in any case, the reason you're seeing the bright part illuminated there is that the whole Earth is shining onto the lunar landscape and lighting it up brightly enough that it's visible to the naked eye a quarter million miles away back on the Earth. In other words, light is shining from the sun onto the Earth, from the Earth onto the moon, and then from the moon back to the Earth. And if you imagine flying an airplane above the Earth on a night when there's a full moon, you know, you look down, you see the landscape lighting up, right? Now move your airplane back into space, turn into a spacecraft and move it so far back that you can see the whole other side of the Earth. And again, you hope to get all lighted up, in this case by the moon. The whole Earth, as seen from the moon, is 80 times brighter than the full moon is seen from the Earth because of that high albedo that you mentioned, and also really because the Earth is a bigger object. So it's a really bright object, and it looks like a window landscape real well.
I think America 2 months ago had out an article on the spacecraft photos of the Earth.
At night, yes, right. Yeah, I was on Earth 2 months ago, and in fact, it was in print in many other places too, but I'm glad they got it together there. Photographs of the Earth taken at night by Air Force weather satellites, and you can always see the white of the city. There's so much white pollution now from the United States that you can trace the entire country simply in the outline of the whites of the city. You can see the Mexican border, the Canadian border, because they don't have as many whites as we do, at least in some places. But when the pictures are taken in moonlight, you can see the outlines of the land and the water just as well in the daytime. In fact, often better than the daytime, because often there are kinds of clouds which cover weather satellite pictures taken in the daytime, but which go away at night. So you can often see the geography better than the nighttime pictures taken by the light of the full moon. That is something you can see with the naked eye. Gentlemen asked me what you see with the naked eye in the Phobos pictures. The astronauts say you can see the Earth lighted up at night very nicely by the moon. You can make out a fair amount of detail. What they say is really spectacular is flying over tropical areas and seeing the clouds lighted up constantly from within by lightning flashes. And of course, that you can't photograph. You can't photograph very well.
Is the Cisco Department lit up from beyond the terminator the day part of the Earth?
Well, if you were in the crescent part, you'd be seeing the bright Earth also, but of course, that doesn't show on the picture because when you have the sun shining on it, it's a great deal brighter than when you have the Earth shining on it. What I'm trying to show you, though, is that when you have only the Earth shining on it, that's quite enough to light it up physically by the naked eye.
Maybe you answer my question. I understand it. Are the Earth providing
illumination to that
full backlight?
Yeah, to the dark side. It's correct to use the term dark side here, although please note, most of the dark side is on the side towards the Earth. Never use the word dark side to mean the side of the moon facing away from the Earth. At the moment this picture was taken, most of that side was illuminated by the sun. Just because it can't see us doesn't mean it can't see the sun. Okay, sorry for the interruption.
Is the illumination that lights up dark side of the moon coming from the day side of the Earth?
From the day side of the Earth.
Sun.
Yes.
Okay. I thought it was coming from the night side.
No.
From the day side of the Earth.
This picture was taken just after sunset in the place where I was. And so as seen from the moon, most of the disk of the Earth that was visible was daylight, and the little bit that was in the night part, I was way over on one side of the disk of the Earth seen from the moon, and that correlates with the fact that a crescent moon always sets just after sunset. Okay, so it does all hang together. Okay, well, what I want to show you is a truly remarkable picture, which they didn't even know they could take. It turned out the camera was more sensitive than anybody realized by computer processing. You were able to haul this out of the data, a picture of the exact same sort of thing of Phobos illuminated by Mars. And there it is. The reason that the bright part looks so strange is that they have had the computer processing, which is very attentive to this picture, draw lines of equal brightness. But what I draw your attention to is the dark part. That is Phobos by Mars lighting. This is a picture from Science News. Ladies asking me during the intermission where you can get more information about space. The answer is certainly not the standard news media, and the place that I always recommend for someone who wants to keep up with what's going on in space is the magazine Science News. It's only $12.50 a year. It is excellent. I will say I've never found an error in it, but they are very few and far between, and I can cite you errors in previous lectures of mine, too, that I've since discovered. There's a space coverage here. It's in the MSU library. You can look at it and see whether you feel, not that every article is of interest to you, probably won't be because they cover such a wide range, but if there isn't enough in it that's of interest, that's worth $12.50 a year for you, which isn't very much. It's weekly. You can read the whole thing in about an hour. It's very concise, very accurate, very readable, and very concise, and that is a rare combination, as you know. And they just do a superb job, head and shoulders above any other news media you might think of covering the scientific aspect of space. Aviation Week is probably superior for the nuts and bolts engineering aspect, and you will find things about science in that week that you don't find in Science News. But that week is much more expensive and much harder to subscribe to. And anybody who wants the address of Science News, I recommend it so often that finally, in self-defense, I got the book where I carry it with me. So just see me after the lecture, and I'll be happy to give it to you. or you can simply go check out a copy or several copies in the library. Here is a remarkable picture from Mariner 9 of the surface of Mars, and that blackish ellipse there is the shadow of Phobos on Mars. A person who was in that shadow was seen eclipse of the Sun, but it would not be total. The Sun, as seen from Mars, is bigger than Phobos ever gets as seen from Mars. So what you would see this irregular blob being silhouetted against the Sun. That is what is called an annular eclipse of the Sun, not annual, annular, A-N-U-L-A-R. And the Latin word annulus meaning ring, because of the ring of sunlight, in this case a rather fat one, visible around the Sun. Occasionally you can see annular eclipses of the Sun from the Earth as well. Most people have never heard of them. In fact, they are slightly more common than total eclipses, such as the one that we'll have next year. However, a total eclipse is a really magnificent spectacle. An annular eclipse is not as exciting and furthermore dangerous to look at as in any eclipse where, in a phase where the entire Sun is not blotted out the way it is for the total phase of a total eclipse. But there will be an annular eclipse visible in the United States next in 1984, and there will be several others between now and the end of the century. Question here?
In the upper part of the photograph, there are two tracks.
Oh, those tracks are dropouts of lines of data.
Why are they linear? Why
is
the dropouts occur so
quickly across? Oh, I don't know. You'll have to see that on your own television screen. It's rather best answer I can give you. These are television pictures that are being transmitted from many tens of millions of miles away.
There's standard circuitry now
that's
peaked in the element from right above, so you'll see dropouts.
Yes, I know, and this has not been treated that way. Okay. Here's another set of shadow of Phobos pictures from Viking Orbiter 1. And there, the shadow moved across Viking Lander 1. Phobos moved so fast, the whole eclipse is over in just a few seconds. You know, it didn't blob across the Sun, and that's it. It moved off. And they took advantage of that fact. They had the lander take photographs of the shadow on the ground at the same time as the orbiter was photographing the shadow from above. And by doing that, they were able to get the position of the lander narrowed down to a couple of hundred feet. As I mentioned, they've been able to do even better than that since by direct photography, but at the time, this gave us our best knowledge of the position of Viking Lander 1. It's kind of remarkable that the lander actually turned out to be in a place where there was going to be an eclipse. Of course, there are an awful lot of eclipses in Phobos that moves around Mars so rapidly. And that is it. So, I thank you very much for your interest in this lecture and in the others. I'm sorry that we went to space. The reason the crowd was so sparse is not that MSU students have suddenly lost interest, but we goofed somehow on the advertising, although we've been racking our brains trying to figure out exactly, you know, what we did wrong this time and we did the others. But in any case, I'm very happy that you did learn about them. I will be back in April and May to teach that course. It is possible that I'll give some lectures, some public lectures at that time also. Thinking is still being done about that, you know, like how much money do they have in my very generous sources and so forth. But it's possible to have some public lectures there. In any case, the course is definite. And for those of you who can make it down to Rochester, Michigan, to Open University, hope to see some of you for the space compensation lecture. Perhaps it's not obvious the reason, but I won't be here in between. I'm going out to California for Pioneer Venus and for the Voyager Jupiter flybys, and if I'm lucky to take Canaveral for the shuttle flight, first shuttle flights in orbit and so forth, and I'll give them all that information and I'll bring it back to you, and I hope that eventually we'll be able to come back and do some more public lectures anyway. So between now and then, I hereby charge each of you with the sacred duty of taking up 10 additional people so the next time I'm back. Thanks very much. Colonies in Space by T.A. Heppenheimer, H-E-P-P-E-N-H-E-I-M-E-R. The hardcover is published by Stackpole Books, which I'm sure you've never heard about. It was a very small publisher. They did a fine job on the book. And the paperback is published by Warner Communications. The O'Neill book, I recommend you get the paperback because the hardcover is a year. He rewrote the book for the paperback. Heppenheimer did not, the same book. But O'Neill rewrote it so it's a year more up to date. And that is published by Bantam. If you want to buy the hardcover, it is published by Morrow. You know, we're not, the question is, the Viking seismic instruments discover anything more than the first couple of tremors? We're not even sure they discovered the first couple of tremors. At this point, it is not certain that there has been a single Mars quake ever observed. Which is really strange. Even the moon has seismic activity, as I talked about last night. And you'd think that Mars, you know, general rule, the bigger the planet, the hotter it is inside, and it is this heat that powers the internal geologic activity, you know, the mirror effect, you'd think Mars would have seismic activity. Of course, there is a problem, which is that Viking Lander 1 seismometer did not operate. The only instrument on Lander 1 that didn't work from the very beginning. Lander 2 seismometer did, but if you look at a map of Mars and look at the places where the big volcanoes are and the Great Canyon is and so forth, where you might expect seismic activity if it still exists on Mars, Lander 2 is probably in a much more seismically quiet area. On the other hand, if you land these things on Earth, granted they're not all that sensitive, they're not anything like the Apollo seismometers, Viking was not primarily oriented towards seismometry, believe me. Those instruments were definitely also RAMs and designed. They did the best they could, but they're relatively low in sensitivity, but still, they just picked up quakes on Earth by this time. And it just seems a little, from anywhere on the Earth, you know, so it seems really strange we haven't gotten anything. I think actually there's another hand over there that would lead you to it a little. Yes? No? Okay.
Well, I don't
say Rift Valley does that. Valley Mar and Eric, the big equatorial canyon of Mars, is carved by Williamson. It started out like civilization as a grotto. There's a whole series of grottos. Remember, grottos, the way the ground is falling down and there's some parallel walls to take up a stretching of the crust. Well, here's this big thing, 1,000 miles, 1,200 miles per diameter blister in the Martian crust called the Sarsa Dome, with a volcano sitting up on top of it. All around the edges of the Sarsa Dome, radial to it, you find these grottos. And only one of them happens to be sticking out in the east-west direction where the winds would be most intense, because that's the direction of the prevailing winds there. That is Valles Marineris. So we think now that Valles Marineris originated as one of these grottos, but it was excavated by the winds. Still, you would expect there to be motion along the ground. But those grottos may have formed a billion years ago. No question whatever. Every time they move the Tambor arm, for example, it picks it up. The seismometer has turned out to be a wonderful wind detector. The meteorology team has been using its data much more than the seismology team. You know, they get these wind events all the time. So there's no question the gadget's working. Likewise, there's no question that the Lander 1 seismometer is not working. But just doesn't pick up any definite quakes. There is one event which has the signature that seems to be that of a quake. And the problem is when there's only one, you know, you're very, very hesitant about saying, yeah, that was a quake. See, Mars only had one quake in 2 years of activity. That just seems a little bit unlikely. But if you saw this on Earth, there's one event that you would call a quake. If so, it is a relatively local one, about Richter magnitude 4, about 190 miles away from spacecraft. And even so, if that is a quake, you need to use it to get a crustal thickness for that part of Mars. And you can then factor that into some orbital data from back in Mariner 9, which can be interpreted as crustal thicknesses for the entire planet if you have just one calibration, one spot. You know, so it's terribly important to know whether that was or not in fact a quake. But the last I heard, and this is about 6 months out of, no, about 3 months out of date. Okay, it's been about 3 months since I asked anybody about what the size of stuff. And at that time, nobody on the team was willing to come out and let them say yes, it was a quake.
What about the transition? We talk about how the moon rang like
bells. Yes. Mars does not, and that's not surprising. You have both air between the soil grains and water in the rock. We know we have water in the rocks. There are hydrated minerals in the Martian soil. that was pretty obvious all along. In fact, Mars is red. You know, rust is a hydrated mineral. Actually, the way of thinking is that red is not rust, it's montmorillonite, that is silver. It's nontonite, which is a red, iron-rich version of the clay called montmorillonite. And say it's red, though, then it's red because it's a hydrated and iron-rich mineral.
Well, that's just my question. Is it in the, you have some local dialect?
Yeah.